Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast. This is show number 80, and this week's guest is Alex Yates, and he comes to talk to us about his zines. Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast. This is show number 80, and as always, I have Andrew Bartram with us. Andrew, how's it going?
All right, mate. Yeah, don't sound too enthusiastic. Yeah. Will you?
It's been a long week, man. It's a Christmas week, you know, so I'm a little tired.
This is this period, I'm reliably informed, is called Twixtmas.
Twixtmas? What's that?
Betwixt Christmas and the New Year.
Oh, I gotcha. Yeah.
Twixtmas, do you like that?
Yeah, that's good. I never heard that before.
Yeah. No, I hadn't until I heard it on a radio show the other day.
Physically tired too, because we've had a run of waves. I think I've surfed every day for like 6 days straight, so today's the first day I haven't gone surfing, and it's a workout. So we're blessed with the Christmas gods with surf. You been surfing any, Andrew?
Only the internet.
Cool. It's not known for its surfing in the fens, is it?
That's not.
We've got
plenty
of water.
That voice sneaking in, everybody, is Alex Yates.
Hello, Alex.
Hello. How are you doing? There you go. I'm going to sound enthusiastic. Woohoo!
Ooh, there you go. Thanks.
That's all right.
He's the sunshine of this side of the show, I guess.
We've been trawling our previous guest list for someone who'd want to come on between Christmas and New Year, and we found somebody who wasn't doing anything.
Yeah, well, for me, Christmas, but this period feels like jet lag, and I'm so used to jet lag that it's kind of the same thing, right? You just sort of sit around waiting for your soul to catch up from all the things that have happened in the last few days.
What has, so you've just finished up with a zine, right?
That was yes.
Fans? Yeah. So is that jet lag revolving around that, or is that shot recently and then just kind of put together, or?
No, so that scene is from shots from my last few trips, but I have just I did go to Japan just before Christmas. How do I explain this in a way that doesn't sound like I'm incredibly opportunistic? We had a holiday booked to Hong Kong, and for reasons that are probably fairly obvious, decided that perhaps now was not the best. The best time to go to Hong Kong, so looked for somewhere else in Asia and went back to Japan for trip number 6, which sounds really really self-indulgent and is really self-indulgent, but the images in the zine you're talking about were shot in previous trips, but I will say in this trip, although it was quite short, I was probably more conscious of making images for a kind of follow-up to that zine and potentially a follow-on exhibition to showcase some of those images. So it probably changed my approach to photography a little bit whilst we were in Japan, meaning I shot a little bit less pinhole than I normally would. Although, right. I guess probably in general, I've been shooting a little less pinhole anyway. But the zine has not zonked me at all. What zonked me is just the general joys of work and Christmas colds and that type of thing.
And having to ponder the fact of having to hang out with Andrew tomorrow, that's...
Well, it is a pain. That's why we only do it once a year. But I think I'll probably just about cope. I think the main question on my mind is whose turn is it to buy lunch? But I think I've got
mine.
A record of that somewhere. Is it your turn?
Mine.
Yeah. Hopefully he'll pull up in his caravan and he'll cook you a camp lunch right there and you can take a nap if you need to.
I think I'd rather he bought me lunch.
Yeah, I don't blame you on that one.
No, the caravan's been set on the drive since the end of October. It'll be moving in February, I think, but not before then.
Have you winterized it or just let it sit? I mean, you just clean it and get it all, you know.
No, I looked out the window this morning and it's growing green algae on the roof. No. It does need a good clean. But you drain the water down, which is just normal, and it has a dehumidifier in there, which I just leave on. Right. And I get the battery's on charge. That's about it, really. I just go and check it now and again, go in there.
So, Andrew, the big question with your caravan is when are you going to change it into a pinhole camera?
Well, I have had several people have suggested that. We were not on this podcast. Corey thought we were going to get Brendan Barry on this podcast, but we had him on the large format photography podcast.
Yeah.
And I was most inspired after chatting to him because he's changed a caravan into a pinhole camera, hasn't he? And a dark room. And
so there's a guy in the Netherlands who does it as well, who was featured in Obscura book, which is going back a number of years now, I guess. Obscura, but I'm trying to think when that was, but it was quite some years ago. But this guy in the Netherlands, I think it was called Lucas Castellinus, I remember. His images in Obscura book were, as I recall, taken with his caravan pinhole camera.
I'd love to do it. Brendan took his up onto Dartmoor and he sort of parked up in, I think it was probably on that main drag that goes from sort of Princetown up through the middle. There's several places you can stop, and folks just came up and he said, can I pinhole you?
Or can words I to you? That,
can I words to that effect? And because he's the guys are coming away with a print, you know, he's doing paper negatives. And
what size negatives was he doing?
Reasonable size.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I remember.
That, like, that could be a bra.
No, I think they were reasonable size. I can't remember. He has a couple of YouTube videos on YouTube, and one of them is about his caravan, and the other one is when he converted the 42nd floor of a skyscraper in New York and did all those shots around the New York skyline.
And there's... that's been done. There was a Cuban guy. Well, I think he was Cuban, might have been Spanish, who did a lot of those sort of hotel room shots, turning hotel rooms into camera obscuras rather than pure pinhole cameras, if you like.
I thought Brendan used a lens, like a large format lens.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, it wasn't really a pin. It wasn't a pinhole camera, was it? No, it was a lens. He mainly uses lenses. He sometimes just uses pinholes, but he mainly uses big lenses, doesn't he, for those shots? But it's a bit like a pinhole camera, really. But you know, but it's not.
it's a bit like a pinhole camera with the
lens.
That it isn't. Yeah.
It's a bit like a camera, really.
Well, they're all boxes with a hole to let in light at the end of the day, aren't they?
One way or the other, right?
Yeah.
So sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say, you have two books, Alex.
Yes.
The Japan Hole.
Japan Hole, yes.
Japan Hole.
Yeah.
So I guess the other one is just regular, you used a regular 35 millimeter or whatever.
So maybe talk about Japan Hole first. That kind of, I guess the starting point is I'm extremely lazy in terms of actually printing images. I think this comes from the joys of sharing things online. And at some point I realized that actually if I don't print or at least make anything physically available, one, I don't really have anything to share with what small audience I have. And two, I don't actually have anything physical that I can look at and use myself. So I think the difference between the two, you know, Japan Hole was really a collection of very disparate images taken over probably the first three times we went to Japan. And I think the only thing that kind of really links the images together, if you like, was the fact that they were taken in Japan. There was no kind of theme. But I think what was really interesting about that for me was, you know, as you began to look at the images, apart from the obvious desire to make something pretty, I think that there was always this, I guess, kind of stillness to the image, which is something you see quite a lot in pinhole. And I think something that I've then kind of continued to try and explore a little bit with pinhole images in Japan, and certainly my more recent images, I've very actively sought out places where there are a lot of people and then made images, you know, long exposures where effectively the people disappear. So you then get that stillness back, and that kind of reflects how you feel when you're making the image. So Japan Hole, I think, was really more born out of a desire to produce something really rather than anything else. Ordinary Japan's a little bit different in that that was much more a conscious decision to kind of link images together that show kind of the aesthetics of the country, which is one of the reasons I really like it. And it's something I find much more difficult to do with Pinhole, which is why that's more, but you know, 35mm, if you like, standard 35mm shot with a lens, mostly whilst walking around various cities. And you know, so I think, you know, the philosophy behind them both was very different.
All right. Well,
I like, I have a copy of your Ordinary Japan zine in front of me. I haven't got the Japan, what's it called?
Japan hole.
Yeah.
Japan hole.
Japan. Japan hole, mate. You don't have any copies left, not even for a good old friend who'd buy you lunch.
The pinhole is long gone. So it was a small, because I was really doing something myself, I only made 50 copies of it. Mm. And it was.
How many did you make of the Ordinary Japan? Because you used that.
I made 100 of Ordinary Japan, and I think the difference between the two is the ability in between to find good, cheap places online to print. So Japinhole was made with a very good, I must say, really good sort of traditional printing place just outside Cambridge in the UK. And they were fantastic, but it wasn't cheap. So the cost per copy was pretty high. With Ordinary Japan, I've used an online company who also have been fantastic. And actually, I'm really surprised and pleased with the copy. But the cost per image or the cost per book has been significantly less. So then I could produce more within kind of what budget I set myself.
That's Mixim, is that right?
Mixim. Yeah, I had a few concerns about layout, because I'm a complete klutz at these things. You know, I lay out in a very basic way using InDesign. And when I did that, I had a big concern about particularly whether the center page was set up correctly. But actually Mixim's customer service was very, very good. So although they're online based, you get help from a real person, and they were great. You can also get some kind of proof copies, not of the number of pages I produce, but you know, I could produce a little short run with maybe 10-12 pages, something like that, just to check things. And it all worked out really well. I think the difference between the two is that you don't get with Mixim many options in terms of, for example, different color paper for covers and things like that. It's pretty basic, but then it's not expensive and it's perfect.
Well, I buy a reasonable amount of zines off folks, you know, and quality varies, shall we say?
Yeah.
But this is great. I was very impressed. I've seen another one by Mixim, and it was, I think they must have used a different stock of paper, I guess. This is certainly better. I won't mention the other one, but the other one was very nice. The other one was very nice, but this is better, I have to say. This is a sort of is it A5? I guess that's A5, is it? It looks about half of A4.
Yeah, it's A5.
And a nice clean white cover, Ordinary Japan, and a big red Japanese sun type thing in the middle with your name.
And do you know what I spent most time on, apart from laying it out, was getting the right red colour?
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
So the red colour, it's actually a specific red colour that is used for the for Japan. I think I probably found it on Wikipedia, so it's probably wrong, actually, to be fair. But
looks good.
Well, it's a big red dot, isn't it? It's not hard to do.
It's a big red dot. And your centerfold image works pretty well. There's a girl in what I would say is geisha costume, but it's probably not that at all. But that sort of kimono-y type thing. And she's not geisha because she hasn't got face all whitened out, has she? But...
Right, yeah. So this is something one you've got to be a little bit conscious of in Japan. So it is a traditional kimono. Mm. And actually the guy who's just behind her, whose head is obscured by the panda,
as it would be.
yeah, as it would be, you know, is wearing a yukata. So that's traditional Japanese dress. But the area it was taken is a area called Asakusa, in the centre of Tokyo, and it has a very famous temple called Sensuji. I'm probably mispronouncing all of these things, with a very famous temple gate with a very large traditional lantern. And the area has a lot of places where you can hire kimono and yukata. So lots and lots of tourists, whether they're Japanese tourists, Western, or from other Asian countries, will hire kimono and yukata in these places where there's kind of very traditional temples, very traditional sort of street scenes. And some of them will hire photographers as well. So you see a lot of people who are clearly not necessarily used to wearing the dress, but they're there. It's part of the experience of visiting these areas, so it's kind of fascinating to see that part of the I mean, the whole culture of the place is fascinating anyway, but it is a really interesting kind of aspect of visiting the country, is seeing the different things that people will do to get an experience as a tourist. You know, you wouldn't do that in the UK or in the US, or I can't think of a place in the UK where I would go get dressed up and then wander the streets and have a photographer take my photo, you know, apart from maybe like a Comic-Con or something like that.
Comic-Con.
Yeah. But it's very common. So you see it in, you know, you see it in Tokyo, you see it a lot in Kyoto for sure. I think the key way you can tell the difference between somebody who's used to wearing a dress and someone who isn't in...
Whether they've shaved their legs or not?
No. It's the way they walk. So because the kimono, you can't really tell from that photo, but the kimono is very tight. So you have to take very short steps.
The shuffle?
And so, yeah, most people shuffle, but if you see a geisha, they kind of appear to glide. So even though they're wearing wooden-soled shoes, they make very little noise as they move, and it looks basically completely effortless. It must take years of training, like all of these things, right? But it's you can spot the difference very, very easily, and it's a bit hard to describe if you've not seen it, but you can definitely tell the difference between the tourists and the not tourists.
I don't have a copy of in front of me, but I'm looking at the shots on your website, and I like the colors, especially this blue one with the palettes on the looks like cinder blocks.
That's probably, if it's the one I'm thinking of, I'm just gonna flip
it's just
through.
After so, this just after the center image, Alex.
Yeah, you've got a number of sort of blue palettes, and then on cinder blocks, as you say, with the blue tarpaulin. So, yeah, the blue tarpaulin is an incredibly common feature in Japan. You will see it everywhere. It's used by everyone from builders to homeless people. So homeless people make their shelters using these blue tarpaulins. This isn't that, but it's everywhere. But yeah, that's my favorite image, and I'd love to say it was very conscious the way I composed it, but of course it wasn't. It was
well, you could say it is.
Yeah,
you can't now,
honesty is very important, but the lines in the image, for whatever reason, and hopefully it was subconscious, all match up. So you've got the white line of the road that then kind of goes through the sort of blue tarpaulin and then into the hedge, and on the right-hand side of the image, and then similarly on the left-hand side, the line of the hedge then hits the kind of rope. Mm-hmm. And once I kind of figured that out, I was like, "Oh, I'm kind of really pleased with that." You know, could I recreate it again if I tried? Inevitably not, but you know, let's say it was deliberate.
Well, you got that white line, then you have the curbs, then you have the planter on the other side, and then you have the angle of the pallets plus the bricks on the ground are all going in the same direction as the pallets. So you kind of, and then the background is all vertical. There's like poles and a chimney and, you know, so.
And it's, I think it really illustrates what I'm trying to show in this series, which is, you know, these are really mundane things. You know, there's nothing more mundane than the pallets, some pallets covered with a tarpaulin. But there's something about it that kind of really, really grabs you. And I think this is kind of what I found more and more as I go to Japan, is that these really ordinary, boring scenes, if you like, actually have a real aesthetic beauty to them, and it really drags me in, and it's one of the things that keeps me going back. I think the trick, you know, that I'm going to try and force myself to do this year is to find this same image and the same beauty at home, because it must exist. I'm sure it exists.
Are you going to use the same film stock as you use over there in Japan?
Yeah.
Sure, with the same thing.
Yeah.
What were you using, Alex?
I like the colours. I mean, they're
always portrait. It looks like a portrait. Is it?
Yeah. It's always portrait. Always portrait. So
is it portrait 160?
Yeah. It's one of those. Portrait 160. There's actually a few.
My favourite.
There's a few in there that are actually made with Pro Image 100. Which I really, really like as a stock. They tend to be the ones with the red that's popping a little bit more. I'm really fond of Pro Image. I think it's great. I've not tried it for pinhole. I use Portra 160 pretty much exclusively.
For pinhole color?
But Pro Image, because I really only do pinhole with 120. Pro Image, as far as I'm aware, isn't available in 120 stock. So...
I've not used that, but my daughter has. I've been, funnily enough, developing some Pro Image just yesterday and scanning it. But I would use Portra 160 when I shoot color. Pretty. Yeah.
You like that better than Ektar?
Yeah, I think so. Ektar is a bit too over the top for me. I like the muted tones of Portra 160, particularly around the landscape around here. You see as well. I think it works really well.
The problem I have with Ektar is when it's sunny, it's almost too bright. So what comes back from Ektar is just really too in your face, and it's lovely film, but I don't think it does so well on grey days either. Whereas I think Portra is a bit more universal, and I'm just really used to it, you know. Yeah. So everything in Japinhole, actually, no, that's going to be a lie. Almost everything in Japinhole will have been shot on Portra. I suspect some of them will have been shot on my favourite film stock of all time, Curse You Fuji, which is Fuji Reeler. I adore Fuji Reeler, but, you know, anything that's left now is really, it's expired and probably not worth shooting.
Yeah.
I haven't used the
160 yet. I need to try it. I haven't tried the Portra.
Oh, you should. It is beautiful. I get mine from 7 Day Shop when it's in stock. I get five rolls for $24.99, which is about the best deal you can find, I think.
That's about the same as Ektar, though, isn't it? I haven't bought it in so long. But...
Yeah, I don't buy much, but there we go. Coming back to the aesthetic in your book, I think it's when it comes across having the book in front of you. Because these are mundane scenes, and I'm not saying that in any derogatory way, Alex. But you've brought a certain aesthetic to it. You haven't just rocked up and snapped away. That you're very keen on frames within frames, and sort of, very carefully composed, lots of squares. Do you know what I mean? you can find that elsewhere. But I think going to a place like Japan. Boring things become exciting when the things you're walking past in Norwich are probably, you can find things that are aesthetically, you could put together in much a similar way, but you've got to train your eye to stop and take note of it but this is Japan, and why wouldn't you look for these things, you know?
I think that's it. I mean, I think the, you know, everything you see in a country that's new to you is going to be interesting and exciting, or it is to me, you know, if you're driven by kind of visuals, and I'm very much a visual person. You know, everything is going to be interesting. I love so much about Japan. I think there's an image, Andrew, kind of almost second page into the book, of a sort of set of plants underneath some eaves. And that and on the street, and
is this the one with the bamboo?
It's not bamboo. It's actually yellow plastic over a.
Oh, was it?
yeah. It looks like bamboo. Japan has a bit of a plastic fetish. It's a bit horrifying.
On the stand. Is it sitting in a stand, like an umbrella stand? Is that what you're talking about?
No. I'm not sure this one's on my website, unfortunately, but we'll put it in the show notes if you're still doing those. But it's kind of just a curb by a building, but underneath the curb, and this is really, really common. Every available place is taken up with plants, and that's incredibly common in Japan. You find plants outside buildings everywhere. And the nice thing is, because it's such a kind of respectful society, these things don't get damaged. So, people can leave plants outside without fear of some drunk idiot coming along and knocking it over or smashing it up. And so it makes that walk around the street, something really, really special, because they take these steps to kind of make everything a little bit more than what it is. You don't have to put plants under that eave, but they do because it adds to the beauty of the place. And I think that's fantastic. It's really easy to see. And I think, with images like that, I guess there's probably a little bit of convention in terms of composition that I'm breaking, because it's, I very much shoot from my eye level. I don't, partly because my knees are knackered and my jeans are too tight, I tend not to crouch too much.
you don't want to ruin those expensive Japanese jeans by crouching down.
I'm trying to break a new pair in at the moment, and my God, they're painful. But it's a very different.
It's not a good time. It's not a good time of the year to be breaking jeans, and you need ones with elastic waists, Alex. Do you know what I like about this is? What keeps drawing me back to it is the shadow in the bottom right-hand corner. Yeah. It's almost like Japanese drawing, with the tracery and lines. Whether that was intentional or not, you could say so, but it's but it works really well. And the color palette has worked really well. I'm taking my glasses off now and squinting closely at the page, because that's
The color palette is very deliberate. So because I'm shooting color, in the same way as you say, I look for these kind of frames within frames, and I'm particularly drawn to kind of lines and squares or rectangles, and you can kind of see that in a lot of the images. I'm also always looking either for color contrast or color similarities within an image as well. So, that for sure is part of why I shoot these things, because you can look down and there's that lovely red band along the edge of the road, and that's just love, it's great.
Or the lovely red band straight across those shacks and along the roof line as well, a bit further in.
Yes.
That's an awesome picture. There's something of the order of Japan. I mean, I've not been, but I watched Sue Perkins in Japan recently, and I don't know what you thought of that, but actually I quite enjoyed I thought she handled it quite well, and the people came across as being very kind of respectful, if not some of them were a bit weird, people, but then she focused on
that. I think, how do I feel about
very clean
Sue,
as
how
well.
Do I feel about the Sue Perkins show? Actually was pretty good. There have definitely been worse documentaries about Japan. I think there's part of the challenge I always face, because of knowing the place, I would say relatively well now from having gone, but by no means any kind of expert, but at least having some experience of the place. Part of the challenge is that, a documentary will always try and find things that are very interesting to a Western audience and seem odd. So, for example, that kind of the piece in the Sue Perkins thing where she went to that business school. Now, I work, with Japanese people, and I just can't imagine anyone going to a business school like that who I work with. And it's very, that to me feels like very much the exception rather than the norm, but it makes for good TV.
Yeah, I think that's it. You've got to, I mean, you don't know how common that is. Corey, what we're talking about is a documentary, a BBC documentary. Mm. Sue Perkins, a comedian in the UK. Mm-hmm. I think that's what she is anyway. she did this 2 or 3 episode series on Japan.
Yeah.
And it was this business school, wasn't it? And the people was kind of, there was a sort of some almost ritual humiliation involved, lots of shouting. And
it feels, you know, very much the antithesis, as you said right at the start of kind of how you were introducing, you're saying people are very respectful, and they are. And it's one of the reason we keep going back is the people are wonderful. You know, they're truly wonderful, welcoming, warm, you know, delightful people to interact with. You know, I can honestly say in 6 trips, we've probably never had a bad experience with someone. And we've actually had some exceptional experiences, you know, with people helping us. You know, sometimes language can be a bit difficult, but people will help. Although language really isn't the barrier that people think it is, you know, at least not in my experience, but people will always help. You know, we've had people give us personal guided tours around temples because we've just happened to be there. You know, nice. And so the people are incredible, and it's incredibly respectful, and you get that when you're taking photos. So I guess the best way of illustrating that and bringing it back a bit to Pinhole is whenever I go, I'm on this quest to make the perfect image of the Shibuya Scramble. So, and what's the Shibuya Scramble? So everyone will have seen an image of this who's seen any documentary about Japan. It's the pedestrian crossing where you have 5 or 6 different crossings all going at the same time with just thousands of people on it. And it's just outside a very busy station in the center of Tokyo. And it's a meeting point and really a melting pot for pop culture in that area as well.
Cool.
And so what happens is that rather than in the West where you might let, you know, people cross at one point and another point, it's either all the roads are going or all the people are crossing. And it's really an incredible experience for a couple of reasons. One, just the sheer volume of people is kind of extraordinary in many ways. But that respectfulness comes because nobody walks into each other. And so you've got all of those, and if you think of the huge numbers of people there, no one walks into each other. Same in the train station, same everywhere. You know, they're really conscious of not causing offence or causing a problem for someone else. And that's kind of part of the culture. And it makes making a pinhole image really easy. So this last trip, I as I say, I'm really trying to get the perfect image. So I set up my tripod at the edge of the crossing, you know, keeping out of the way of actually the places where people were walking. And it was probably a 30-minute exposure because of being at night. And exposure is almost impossible to judge because it's very, very brightly lit, but the lighting changes constantly because you've got all these billboards and advertising around, plus you've got lights of the traffic and the people. So it's impossible to meter, so you basically just guess, and I haven't got that film back yet, so we'll see how that works out. But in that 30-minute exposure, I'm right at the edge of the scramble. I think my tripod got nudged once by someone, and that won't have affected the image because it was very, very light. But no one stood in front of the camera.
Right, they just kept moving.
Everyone saw the camera was there. They just accepted it, didn't get any questions about what are you doing, what's that weird wooden box. Right. You know, those types of things. And it's a really, really easy place to make images because it's kind of, people don't assume you're doing something bad because they look at it and go, oh, there's something a bit weird going on there. And so this was with, you know, it's kind of reassuring because particularly when you're using your Kurt Mottweiler curved film plane camera, you know, you don't want anyone to knock it over, and you certainly don't want anyone to kind of take offense to what you're doing. So it's a really easy place to make images, and I found that, you know, even with some of the images in Inch of Pinhole, there's an image there in the bamboo grove at Arashiyama, which is just outside Kyoto. Very famous place, and I took a shot of an artist painting. And, you know, did the usual things. You mind if I take your photo? I took it from behind. He was fine with it. And again, it was a very long exposure. I think that was about 20 minutes because the lighting's really dim. And it's just accepted. It's part of doing things. You have to be polite. You have to be respectful when you're there. And learning a few phrases of Japanese make a real difference. But it's so easy to really kind of immerse yourself in making images, making a craft. One, because it's just fascinating and beautiful, but two, because there's never a problem. And there are places where photography isn't allowed, but where it's not allowed, then it's very, very apparent and obvious that it's not allowed. And that tends to be in some temples for very good reason, you know. And as long as you respect it, it's fine.
Have you been to that festival where they jump on that log and ride that log down the hill? They're wearing the, I don't know what it's called, but the, it's like a loincloth or something, around their waist, like a sumo wrestler kind of thing. That's all they wear, and a headband, and they jump on a log and it slides down a hill.
and again, I think, you know, these festivals have a real meaning, but of course, you know, there was.
Oh yeah, of course. No, I didn't mean like that, but.
Yeah. Oh no. Sorry, but it's once a year, so you've got to be there at the at the right time. But we did go to sumo on our first trip, and that was, we, you know, you think how long are you going to kind of stay interested at sumo? And we were there all day, and it was endlessly fascinating because of the ritual that surrounds every bout. And there's a lot that happens that you don't see on TV. Andrew will remember it was on Channel 4 in the 80s. It was one of their big big shows as that channel was getting up and running. And there's so much that wasn't shown on that. So that's a fantastic experience and well worth doing if you can get tickets.
I watched a documentary that was of the house where they all lived and trained, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They have to feed the older guys or the new guys coming in. They have to, I don't know. It was a whole process. Like day to day was, you know, not just get up in sumo. Everybody had to like do something, and it was all kind of a hierarchy, I guess. I don't know. It was pretty interesting.
Yeah. And that, I mean, we've also seen, you see some of that hierarchy even in the music and some of the idol groups, particularly the larger ones. You know, there's groups like AKB48, which, as the name suggests, have 48 members, and there's a hierarchy there in terms of the membership as well. And it's probably not as ritualized, or I'm sure it isn't as ritualized as the sumo, but it's still there, and you see it in the workplace as well. And kind of coming back to documentaries and things, if anyone really wants to get an insight into ordinary Japan as opposed to what you see in Western documentaries, then the NHK World Channel, which is their national broadcaster's English language channel, has some incredible documentary shows, the likes of which you don't see in the West at all. And the one we really, really enjoy is called Document 72 Hours, where they basically send a film crew somewhere and the film crew films for 72 hours in one place. And it's really, you know, and it's going to sound really boring. They film in places like by a vending machine that serves noodles, and they film the people who come to that vending machine to eat noodles and find out about their lives. And honestly, it really grabs you as a piece of...
Have you shared stuff? I've seen that. There's a vending machine, a very old style noodle vending machine, which keeps breaking down. And when it breaks down, a little old woman comes out
and
kicks it and opens it up. And this guy made a film of the people who were coming up to it. And I forget whether they engaged with them or not, but there was this... And from memory, that noodle machine was like a dying generation. There aren't so many of them now, but this was like people were coming to it at all hours, weren't they? In the middle of the night and like 3 a.m. And
stuff. So the research that goes into making that program must be something else to find somewhere like that. But it's worlds apart from the kind of Western documentaries about Japan, which kind of seem to lay out the old tropes and like.
Is that a Sky thing?
No, NHK World. It is. So, I mean, it's available on, probably not on Freeview, it is on Sky, it's on cable as well in the UK. And
good.
Yeah.
But I think you must have shared that link. It must have been you who shared that link a year or two ago.
Probably.
And I thought it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
And it's great. And they have, you know, there's various shows that are really, really interesting. But again, you get this kind of insight into a very different sort of cultural experience, which is one of the things, you know, I mean, the reason I love Japan, apart from anything, is it gives my brain a complete rest because, you know, you go and you have to focus on being in Japan. You can't think about anything else because it's so different. The language is different. The sounds in the cities in particular are very, very different.
You just immerse yourself in it and just...
Yeah, yeah. And we've become... I think what we've done in the last few trips and probably what's enabled me to make a lot of the images in ordinary Japan and probably pulled me a little bit more away from doing pinhole whilst I've been there is we've done a lot of walking. And so, you know, we will pick two places in the city that we want to visit and we'll walk between them, you know, maybe for 2 hours. And you get off the beaten track, you get out of the city and there's so much in Tokyo, there's so much of the city is still on the old narrow street patterns where you can barely get a car down. So you've got these lovely places that you can walk that are really, again, have this aesthetic because everyone has plants and the areas are really well kept, even though, you know, some of them may not be the richest part of town. You know, it's always really well kept and you can just walk through the city and you'll always be able to find a drink because there's vending machines everywhere and you can come across these really amazing places. So, you know, I've taken this last trip, although I only shot a roll of pinhole, most of it was shot in a park on one of these walks because it was just stunning. The autumn leaves were in full colour and, you know, I know where the park is, but would you ever go there as a tourist if you weren't walking from one place to another? No, you probably wouldn't. And it's great. So that really, I think if anyone is going, is my recommendation is, yeah, do the touristy stuff, but get off the beaten track and discover the place.
Well, it's never occurred to me to do what you've said. I love the idea of getting off the beaten track. I think it's what a lot of us try and do, but actually by picking these two points that could be, you know, a mile or 2 miles apart, probably no more than that, I would think, and then kind of just aiming for it, but not having a set route, but, you know, and there you're just seeing so much.
And
maybe we could do that tomorrow. Let's pick a couple of places in Norwich.
Yeah, it's really,
let's see if we can do it.
It's really easy. I think the difference in Norwich is you can't really get lost in the way, or, you know, if you don't know the city, you can do, but it's, you know, what's so great about doing this in a place that's unfamiliar, and we do this all over wherever we go now, is you can truly get lost. You know, you can plot a route and you can look at it on Google Maps, but you've no idea what you're going to see. And that's great. And it's really inspiring because then I think if you're interested in making images and you know the type of image you want to make, you'll always find something. You know, and I think this is where, for me, where pinhole is going now is I've had enough personally of making pretty things. Do you know what I mean? You know, it's very easy with pinhole to make a really nice pretty image of something. You know, waterfalls are the classic example. Right.
Or something very impactful because you can get really close to things.
Yeah. But I more and more I want my images to kind of have a cohesive message and tell a story. And I've not yet really found what that story is I want to tell with pinhole. I've got a few ideas that are coming to me, and I think a project that's, you know, really just starting, which Andrew, you'll be part of tomorrow, so you'll get to find out a little bit more about
you're that. In Andrew
yeah
well I think I might be part of Neil Piper's project as well. I think it was Alex Purcell and probably Neil. I think Alex started it. They're doing something, aren't they, with pinhole portraits? Not like I did, we're just sort of holding them up. But they're sort of taking on a Justin Quinnell approach to it. Alex was using FP4 in his Zero, I think. And I'm guessing he's holding the camera sort of up to your eye or your face, and then blinding you with a flash. And then I saw a great picture on, I think it was Instagram, where he'd got, it was the same roll of the same frame, and it flashed it, and then he must have just moved the camera to the other side and got another part of the face. And so you're getting a very blackened background and a really sharp bit of face.
That sounds really good. And again, you know, I think this is the hunt for me, is to find that cohesive series of images, you know, because as I say, it's really, you know, easy to make a pretty image, and you know, I guess you can say there's a cohesiveness in trying to constantly make the perfect picture of the should be a scramble, but I need to do a little bit more with it than just making pretty.
I love the idea with all photography that you can take it where you want. We've all got these little projects bubbling away. My pinhole photography has been a bit in the doldrums recently, and that's mainly because I'm thinking of doing more darkroom work using pinhole images, but I've not been drawn to making pinhole images. But this Christmas time, we've had lots of people around, and I loaded a couple of pinhole cameras up, and I just put them around the place, you know, and I've captured, last year I did it on slide film, this year I've captured bits of Christmas using pinhole, and that's like a little mini story, isn't it, just for Christmas and the family.
And I think, coming back to what I was saying before, you know, this idea of stillness in an image is something you can capture really well in pinhole, in a way that I don't think you can with a lens, unless you're kind of using a big stopper or one of the other similar filters that are available to, you know, really stop down and drive for a long exposure. And I kind of don't see the point personally of using a big stopper when you can just use a pinhole.
I agree, totally,
you know, but you can really capture some stillness, because the movement, I love the fact that movement disappears, particularly of people, and I really like getting a kind of almost seeing a map of movement. And I think my favorite pinhole image that I've made in the last few years was made in a temple in Kyoto called Kiyomitsudera, which is an incredibly busy temple. It's right bang on the tourist trail, but it's beautiful. And at the back of the temple, there's a waterfall which divides into three kind of spouts that then come over a pool, and you queue up to take a drink from one of the spouts and make a wish. And depending on which spout you drink from depends on whether you're wishing for love or wealth or happiness, I think it is. And so I made this image of a group of school children queuing up, and they were kind of moving through in a very regimented fashion. And thoroughly enjoyed making the image, because as they were queuing up, they were cheering everyone's choices that they were making at the waterfall. And particularly when the boys were making a choice to choose romance, and then this huge cheer would go up from all of the girls. And so it was this incredibly, incredibly fascinating image to make. And then the results I absolutely adore, because you just see these like little almost stutters of the people moving across the image, and you can just see the waterfall in the back. And I'll give you a copy of that one to share for the show notes. But it kind of shows that, again, if you can pick the right place, you can kind of find in these scenes where there's noise and movement and everything, you can find a stillness that's really fascinating. And I completely adore both the results of it, but also just making it. Every time I look at the image, it really takes me back, and I can hear the cheers, I can hear the joy in people's
cool.
Can folks find this on your Pinholista Instagram site?
Is it that particular on image or... Pinhalista? Let me just double check. I think it is, and if not, I can, as I say, I can definitely make it. Ping it for you.
Well, I'll also share some of the images that you've been talking about. If there's ones particularly you want folks to be drawn to, I'll post them into the Lensless Podcast Facebook group as well, because that's where a lot that's where a lot of the interaction goes on.
Yeah, so the Instagram for sure will have it. Let me have a look. I can tell you when it was posted.
Folks listening, you can find Alex's work both in his wonderful zine, which I think he's still got copies available.
Copies are available. Both the other really nice thing about the zine is there's been some retailers in Norwich who picked it up,
nice.
Excellent. Which has been really, really exciting. Good. You know, actually being in shops, it's kind of cool.
And so it's Instagram.com/pinholista, PINHOLISTA.
Yes. I keep thinking I should change the name because I'm doing less and less pinhole, but then it's kind of quite recognisable as me. So
we associate you with pinhole, although I'm glad to see you're doing keeping up the instant work as well. There's some lovely instant work, and you've got one of those mint cameras. I'm not sure I knew you had a mint SLR camera.
Anyway. Well, that was a... an indulgence for sure, but it's, I think if anyone's thinking of picking up an SX70, those mint cameras are fantastic. What's really great about it is you can shoot with 600 film because it has without an ND filter, because they modify the electronics, and then you get a kind of little control module that you then ping onto the where the flash bar would normally go, that then you can use to adjust the shutter speed. You can do long exposures with it. There's a B setting and a T setting, so it's awesome. I really, really like that.
It is very versatile. Yeah, I enjoy using my SX70 Alpha 1, and I've recently got the mint flash bar, which I've been using in daylight, and I love the effect you get using it in daylight. And then it's been fun, but it doesn't offer the same degree as control as your camera.
No, but that's. You know, that's okay, right? Because that's the most important thing is to have fun with it. The other camera, instant camera, I've been using a little bit recently, which I do really like, is the Instax Mini Leeplay, which is the Fuji's most recent. It's like a hybrid, so it's the first Instax camera they've made with a glass lens. And it then has, you know, but it acts as a digital camera, but you can use it pretty much as an instant. You can shoot and then press the print button. It'll print straight away, but it also works as a printer as a printer as well. So it's a really nice.
You know, that passed me by. I've just seen.
Yeah, it's a cool. Okay. It's a cool little thing.
There we go. I've got it on. I've just looked it up while you've been talking.
Yeah.
So that's LIPLAY.
Yes.
Yeah. It looks like a digital camera.
I mean, it is a digital camera with an Instax.
I suppose it is
with an Instax printer at the back end of it.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm now really struggling. I've been looking to see if I can find that. Picture either on my Instagram or on my website, and I can't, because I'm really, really bad at archiving these things, but it'll be there somewhere.
Find it and share it with us. And we'll put it into the Facebook group.
So it's on my blog on my website, alexyates-photography.com, from August the 1st, 2017. The page is called Japan 4 using Roman numerals -pinhole. And it's the kind of featured image on that post. And it's there, but I can give you a link as well.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, and there's a few other pinhole images. So I've just had an exhibition in Norwich in a coffee store that closed just before Christmas. So that's finished now, which had a few prints of pinhole images made in Japan, but then also some images I made within the coffee shop as it was being refurbished. So that's kind of one of my projects I've been toying with Pinhole, which is a bit stop start, is people doing things. Again, you get that kind of stillness in the image and the people doing things. And I really like taking images of, you know, craftspeople. So whatever, somebody restoring a shop and making furniture was the focus of a lot of that exhibition. But then,
yeah, that was great because you documented using Pinhole the restoration of that place, didn't you? And then you had a little exhibition of pictures.
Yeah.
Afterwards,
yeah. And I've done similar things. I've done some Pinhole images of somebody making ceramics, and then also some images in a denim factory outside Barcelona. Which kind of links two of my interests together.
While we're on the subject of exhibitions, yeah. we haven't pushed it much on the show. When Joe Baker, who we'll see tomorrow, was on with me earlier in the year, he was talking about a little coffee shop in Norwich, which is the Mustard Coffee Shop.
Yeah,
is it?
The Mustard, very wonderful Mustard Coffee Shop. Yeah.
So when Joe and I were there earlier in the year, we were chatting with the owner and talking about exhibitions, and we have a space for an exhibition. I think it's March and April, yeah. And we've been asking for 8x10 prints, Pinhole pictures to be sent to Joe. Yeah. And we're going to discuss it tomorrow, actually, about how we might best display those. So if you haven't submitted a print and you'd like to, I don't know how many we've got, but and I think Joe is suggesting you've got till the end of the year, so you got a few days. And if you haven't got Joe's address, just contact me or Joe if you're in touch with him on social media. He is the famous evil_chutney. We'll get you his address, and he just wants an 8x10 print from you, not a digital file, but a nice old-fashioned print, please. And we, you know, you'll have your picture up in a little coffee shop in Norwich.
Yep. Awesome.
Yeah, and it's a nice space as well. It's right in the centre of the city, near, if anyone knows Norwich, it's near the Bridewell Museum, which has, like many museums in Norfolk, has an old Alex Yates artifact within the Bridewell Museum as well. Which is all
something you've placed there.
Well, so my mum used to work for Norfolk Museum Service. She actually set up. So she set up one of the museums, the Rural Life Museum in Gressonhall. And so one of the perils of your mother being a curator is your old things that you think are going in the trash suddenly appear in a museum or something.
Right.
And you may not realize it until somebody tags you on Facebook and says, "Is this yours?" And that is the case. So the Bridewell Museum has one of my Norwich City shirts from when I was very young in it. And I had no idea, or I'd forgot, I probably did know, but then I'd forgotten that it was there until somebody tagged me on Facebook and said, "It's yours." And yes, at least it proves, if nothing, that I'm not a glory hunter, although I don't think Norwich has many glory hunters, to be fair. You'll be pleased to know, Corey, that Norwich are doing incredibly well in the Premiership this year.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Is that the caravan?
Yeah, it's a soccer team. Norwich is so... is doing so well. It's such a powerful team. It's holding up all the other teams in the league on its shoulders.
My friend plays soccer.
Does he? Well,
he could probably improve Norwich if they came and play for him.
Yeah, possibly. You should encourage him maybe not to watch Norwich. Actually, no. To be fair, they're very, very entertaining to watch. They just can't.
They play some good football. It's just that they haven't won much.
We seem to have a perennial problem of letting the opposition score more goals than we score against them.
Oh, yeah, that's a problem. Yeah,
it tends to be an issue, but at least we've got the test match to fall back on, right? There you go. Which is also not going very well.
Well, yeah, it's a bit of a... I think we probably struggle to do that run chase over the next couple of days, but we haven't lost a wicket so far.
No, it's very true. I'm quite enjoying the fact that there's a Boxing Day test this year. I mean, at least
a what?
And at least we're not. Sorry, Corey.
Yeah, but it's not on. It's not on the radio, though, is it? I hadn't really tweaked. I went looking for it on the radio, and BBC were outgunned by Talk Sport for the cricket this year, and Talk Sport haven't been interested in cricket for years, but they opportunistically, and I say this because I hate commercial stations, they opportunistically jumped in on the back of England winning the Cricket World Cup.
I think they've done that deal beforehand because there was some earlier in the summer they did. Were on Talk Sport as well. I'm not sure it was completely based on the Cricket World Cup. And Corey, you'd be interested to know that when we say World Cup, we actually have more.
It's a proper World Cup.
There are more countries than just the US.
Yeah, yeah.
You have Canada in your World Series, don't you?
Canada. For baseball?
Yeah.
I think so. I'm not into any of that stuff. I don't pay attention to any of it, so I'm not the best person to ask.
Or troll.
Sure.
that failed miserably, didn't it? A whole attempt to get a rise, and it didn't work at all.
I'm sorry, guys.
That's okay.
Have you been up to anything pinholy recently then, Corey? We didn't have I didn't ask you that earlier.
Just finishing up with the GitSwap camera.
Uh-huh.
And that's been about it. Got all my chemicals remixed, so I've been doing some developing.
Some stand developing using Rodnall? I have been,
yep. That's my new go-to. I don't know why, I just like it. So.
Very good. Yes.
That's been about it. I've kind of been in the same way, just kind of slumping, you know?
Have you stuck a pinhole camera to your surfboard yet?
No, I was thinking about that the other day, and I was thinking about trying to get like a... they sell these plastic bags that you can put your camera in, you know?
Yeah, it's called a Ziploc bag.
Well, no, they have a step up from Ziploc, actually. It's like two bags in one, and it has this fold-over seal. You know, it's like a proper, like, diving camera. Like, you could take it, you know, 15 meters under the water or whatever. And I was trying to figure out a way to do it, but I don't think it's not going to work.
I can give you an alternative proposal, Corey, if you're not averse to a little bit of DIY and 35 mils. So you can buy semi-disposable waterproof cameras.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really cheap. I think I got one that was less than £10 that they have like a little plastic waterproof housing.
I know what you're talking about.
A camera body within which has a lens which you can knock out with a screwdriver.
That's
and then
a good idea.
You can trash the shutter as well, and then obviously mount your own pinhole. And then what I used when I did this for a shutter was I used you can get these kind of bendable sticky back magnets.
Mm-hmm.
That you can also cut holes in, so you can actually mount a circle of magnet on the front of the camera with the adhesive, and it's kind of pretty waterproof, as I remember. Punch a hole in that before you mount it, using a hole punch, and then another circle of magnet on top of it, and then you've got a shutter.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, worked really well, and I did a few sort of underwater shots with that. Never had a problem with the film or anything like that. So that's a nice way of DIYing it rather than getting some expensive Ziploc bag.
Yeah. I was almost thinking about just going out one day when it's really small, the waves are smaller, you know, and just having it in a Ziploc bag with me. And just taking pictures, take it out, you know, and just take a picture and then put it back in and zip it up. You know what I mean? When it's really small, not like, you know, much bigger days where you're having to go under and duck dive and stuff, you know? So I don't know. Maybe we'll figure something out.
But it wouldn't, something like that wouldn't affect the sort of balance of the board, I guess.
Well, that's part of the whole thing. I'm going to have to like, maybe figure out a way to make, a strap that I can like attach to the zipper on my wetsuit, you know?
Yeah.
And just leave a little bit of air in it so it kind of floats.
Mm-hmm.
Something small, a small camera, you know? I don't know. There's so many different ideas. to do.
Because you must be able to get mounts for action cameras that you could use to mount a pinhole.
Yeah, you can get those GoPro things, but
yeah,
I don't know. I almost kind of like don't want to try and bring that side of it into it because I enjoy it for what it is, you know?
Yeah.
And I have enough photography stuff going on that I don't really want to like have to. When I go out to do that, I'm enjoying it and I'm doing that, and I kind of like can leave cameras behind, you know?
Totally.
I think it's important to have a couple hobbies that you're into or other things that you do that are completely, you know, don't involve photography. I know some people are going to say that's blasphemy, but, you know,
what's wrong with you?
You know, because, like, I don't know. I'm just that way, you know? So
I kind of agree. I've never had the urge to take a camera cycling apart from my phone.
Yeah, it's going to ruin it, you know. It's kind of like going.
It's just I'm a terrible cyclist, so I don't really want anyone to.
Well, it's kind of like going places, you know, with your family. Like I kind of almost stopped bringing a camera because if I have a camera in my hand, then I just pay attention to that and not, you know, what we're doing and where we're at, you know.
I can almost feel Andrew twitching in the background.
Yeah, I know.
No, I'm being deliberately quiet. No,
I mean, you know, everybody, different things work for everybody, you know, and.
I'm sure there was a TV show about that once, wasn't there?
Yeah.
I think you're right, actually, because I think even when, the trouble is, even when I'm out and I'm with family and I don't have a camera with me, I'm constantly looking at things photographically. And so sometimes I'm, you know, my wife will be talking to me and I'm kind of miles away because I'm thinking, oh, look at the way the light's falling on that door frame or something.
do you do little frames with your hand, Andrew? I'm kind of imagining you like David Bailey or the guy in that film Blow Up, and you're sort of constantly walking around making a frame.
He has one of those director lenses, you know, where he is like always looking through it.
Yeah, I did have one of those. No, I did have one of those. I sold it as a useless bit of kit. I've lent my copy of Blow Up to Jimmy Hickford, and I've completely forgotten about it until he reminded me the other day. So I might send him a message to bring that tomorrow.
There you go.
Have you seen that film, Corey?
I haven't. I'll have to watch it. No, I haven't seen it.
I was so inspired by watching that I went out and bought a Nikon F2. It wasn't quite a Nikon F, but it was a Nikon F2.
It's very much in its time. I'm not sure it's the...
Damn those photography movies. Yeah, it is, isn't it?
I'm not sure it's the best photography movie.
I tell you, the most fun photography movie I've seen, have you seen Pecker?
Yeah, that's a good movie. I've seen it a long time ago.
It's got the most curious of titles. But you look it up, Alex.
You'll
Pecker.
Like it. It's a good movie.
Yeah, it is great.
Yeah, that's a good movie.
Do I have a fun photography movie?
Yeah, well, you can do that. You can do that top 20 movies for photography or something, can't you? And it has like 1 hour photo in there and Rear Window and Blow Up and...
Kodachrome.
I got Peckers in there. Kodachrome, it's probably in there now.
I don't like any of those movies. I'm not into those movies. I don't know what it is.
I think it's good to watch TV and movies to kind of see the cinematography. I think the one that really stands out for me in terms of cinematography from the last few years is the French series Le Revenant. One, because it had an incredible soundtrack by Mogwai, which was remarkable. But I think it was, in English, it was titled The Returned. And I think they may have remade it in the US as well, but the original French version, particularly the first series, the cinema photography is fantastic, and it's got this really amazing...
What's that called, Alex?
The Returned in English. And it's got this amazing muted colour palette that it's set in the Alps, and the whole thing feels cold because of the colour palette in the cinematography. It's absolutely wonderful.
So this is a TV series, French The Returned, French Le Revenant. Yeah. It's a French supernatural drama television series.
It's quite hard watch in places because it is quite spooky. And the soundtrack is by Mogwai, which is really good. The soundtrack really kind of helps build the atmosphere, but it's beautifully shot. Absolutely beautiful.
See where I can track that down. They'd probably have to change the name for the American viewers. It's a bit like, what was that movie, Le Mans 66? They had to change that into America for Ford versus Ferrari, yeah.
Is that what that was?
Because they thought the Americans would say, hey, what's this Lemon 66 all about?
Probably won't travel down that path of insulting Americans. I work with too many of them.
Why not?
Well, because I work with too many of them.
Well, they're not going to listen to this.
Yeah, that's a fair point well made, but you never know. They might stumble across it at some point in the future. Be like, what did you say?
No. I heard
I'll have
you
to see where I can track this series down.
I think I've got the first series on DVD, Andrew, so if I remember, I will bring it for you tomorrow.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thinking of giving, you're thinking of lending it to me, but talking of giving things, any Ko-fi donations? We don't push it much, do we?
Haven't been any in a while.
Maybe if folk listening wanted to donate for our second zine or something, how do they go about donating to the Lensless Podcast?
I will put a link in the show notes. Well, you can go to ko-fi.com/ The Lensless Podcast.
The Lensless Podcast. Yes, I think you've got to have the full title there, haven't you? The Lensless Podcast, Ko-fi, KOFI.com.
I don't know, kind of. We should be gearing up for something again soon, so we'll see.
Mm. Well, I mean, if you are bringing things back around full circle, if you're looking at places to print when you do your next scene, then Mixam is definitely worth looking at. They're great.
Maybe because we had help with the printing this year, didn't we? Dan Novak in the States did it, but maybe we could do one in the UK next time around. You know,
that'd be awesome.
Mixam. Me and Alex can perhaps work on it together and use Mixam. Yeah.
Or other printers, which I'm sure are available.
No, but this is great. You know, I mean, it's good quality paper. I love the images. I did meant to say to you last night, Alex. I was flipping. I sat on the sofa, and I picked up a book off my bookshelf, and it was Stephen Shaw's American Surfaces. And apart from the lack of food pictures and pictures of your hotel room. It kind of reminded me of that, you know, and I was drawn to your pictures, you know. It's not the same, but there's echoes.
Stephen Shaw is a huge influence on my lens base work.
He does a lot of those lines and squares, and very careful compositions, doesn't he?
He also produced, so because he teaches photography as well, he produced a fantastic book called The Nature of Photographs.
That's great.
Which is just incredible. And it's a really, it's probably one of my favorite books about composition because I like the fact that it's not just his images. There's found images, there's loads of different photographers in there, and he talks in a very simple way about what makes the image work. So I mean that has been a real influence. The other one I really like on composition is in the Aperture series, Larry Fink.
I haven't read that yet. I bought that at the Open Eye Gallery last year, and it sat on my— it's called On Composition, I think, isn't it?
And I think my favourite piece of it— there's a frame somewhere in the book, and I don't have it in front of me, so I don't remember, where he talks about not cropping out part of an image because it added tension. And you know how it's very easy when you're looking at an image, if you've got a little bit of an edge of the frame. So let's say, for example, in the image in the centre of my zine, you've got that kind of black line at the right hand edge of the frame, and it would be very easy to kind of crop that out. But his point, and I don't think this image exemplifies it really well, is that actually having that piece of detail that kind of jars against the rest of the image can really draw the— you know, sometimes it's very distracting, but at other times it can add a bit of—
solidifies
tension.
It
Yeah, and almost balances an image in a way that you don't expect. And I think, as you know, particularly when we're editing images, we very often edit out things that we feel there shouldn't be there. And one of the things I try and do now with most of my images, I do very little post-processing work. I don't crop, I don't adjust color or levels very much. Generally, it's really pretty much a shot unless I've got my lines and my angles way off. I can't be doing with a horizon that's on the huh, as we would say in Norfolk. Corey won't understand that, but you know, anything that's on the huh has to be changed. But apart from that, you know, very little in terms of.
Do your horizons end up being on the huh?
Corey? Often, yes.
Corey, no, not you, Corey.
My horizons are all over the place, man.
Are they on the huh?
I don't know what that means.
Not level.
No, I have a little bubble on top of my camera. Then
it doesn't help. The bubble, honestly, the number of pinhole shots I've got back where I thought I've got the bubble level and it really isn't. It's just like, maybe the camera's not straight inside. That could be
that's what it is.
The fun thing about, I've started playing with my Horizon camera, and as that lens swings round, you can have the camera level, and so you get the. I did a shot of, inevitably, of a Fenland drain, and it's got the horizon level. But going across the top of the scene is a.
Sounds empty.
A wire, you know, a wire, you know, like a telegraph wire or something. So the horizon's straight, and the telegraph wire forms like a rainbow shape. Because of the distortion of the lens, it's really, really weird. Yeah.
Well, you get that with Kurt's P90 as well. Any curved plane. I think any curved plane camera, it's, you know, you.
Okay. You get the center, but you can get that distortion at the
end. I think just simply because the way the light falls on it. I mean, I'm sure Kat would probably disagree because he has much more technical knowledge than I do, but it's probably more to do with my failings than it's certainly not anything to do with his camera.
He has a proper bubble. a super bubble.
Yeah.
A double bubble.
I'm sure there was a song about that as well. Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, let's. Alex, you want to let everybody
Beer
know?
Time.
Yeah, let's. You know, want to let everybody know where they can track you down and check you out.
Yeah, well, I think Andrew's already plugged it well. So,
okay.
On Instagram, I am Pinholista. So, if you search for me on that, you'll find me, and then from there, that will take you. There's a link to my sort of little photography website, and then I've got various other things. But I think start at Instagram and. You'll find me there, and I'm on Twitter, but I don't remember the name of my Twitter account. So,
good. I don't need it.
Well, it changes all the time.
Yeah.
But I think if you type in the old Penfold, it normally.
The old Penfold. Thank you. That's the that's the actual name.
That's the actual name. Yeah. But then the bit that goes with it, you change all the time. Sometimes it's like your name, I don't know what goes.
I get bored. I think I might be once a git, always a git, at the moment. Because I am the original Git, so
right.
You know, for those of you using the Git swap camera, there may be a little bit of me somewhere in that.
I have it.
There you go.
I have it right now.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So that comes from the older podcast about pinhole photography that was on a very short lived run a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. I listened to it.
I used to listen. Yeah. No, I listened to that.
Yeah,
great.
All right.
Good. Perfect. Well, thank you, guys. It's been a really enjoyable rambling chat. Mm-hmm. So, but thank you.
Yeah. Andrew, do you have anything to say? Andrew?
No, not much. I'm looking forward to tomorrow, some pinhole photography. I'm super looking forward to next April, if it is. Yes, when we meet up in Dublin. Looking forward to that.
Cool.
And we look forward to seeing you there.
Yeah,
Corey.
I'll be there.
Still got time to get your passport request in.
I'll be there with bells on.
You should be. It will be a most enjoyable weekend. It's always good fun.
No, thanks for coming on, Alex. It's been lovely just
just talk.
Rambling with you. Yeah, it's been great.
Well, there you go.
But I love Japan. Japan is
tomorrow because
Japan is one of those places that's just massively high on my list of places to go.
Yeah,
me too.
So I'm always excited, and I'm hoping to meet up with Dom Silverthorne.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Early in the new year, he messaged me about perhaps meeting up in London. Nice. So when I know when that is, I'll share the date and see if we can get a few folks down in London to meet up with Dom.
Cool.
Well, everyone have a happy new year, and we hope everybody had a good holidays. And we'll talk to everybody soon.
Yep.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks. Bye, guys.
Bye.
I don't know. So, how's it going? How was Christmas? Christmassy?
Christmassy. It's lovely.
Alex.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Okay. Good. Finally.
Yep.
Okay. Can everybody hear everybody? Hello, Alex. How are you?
I'm good.
Not yet. You guys finish doing what you're doing.
Huh?
Not you guys. I'm talking to you. You guys.
Just slap them around the head and tell them to get out of the room. What do they think this is?
I know, right? How's everyone's Christmas?
Good so far.